This is Richard Verone, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. Richard Hamilton. Today is April 10th, 2003. It's approximately 8:37 a.m. Central Standard Time. I am in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Hamilton, you are in Frisco, Texas. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't we start with a brief biographical sketch of yourself, sir. Could you tell me when and where you're born and a little bit about where you grew up?
Well, I was born in Portland, Oregon, mm-hmm. in 1932. My early years, my father happened to be doing quite well at that point, and we lived in a nice section in northern Portland, mm-hmm. which was fairly close to the airport. My life, I guess, as a small boy was pretty normal. In those days, anyway, we had a lot of vacant lots and places to play, and we did all sorts of fun stuff with the other kids in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
About the time that World War II was getting close, my father had a problem with work, and we ended up moving mm-hmm. to a smaller house and a little less costly to us, I believe. In that area, I also made new friends. We had all the standard stuff that kids do in those days, which was mostly outside. We didn't have TV, obviously, so it was mostly outside events and playing in the neighborhood, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My father, unfortunately, had a problem with alcohol, and my family broke up.
Mm-hmm.
About 1942.
Okay.
But at that second location in my life is when Pearl Harbor was bombed, and mm-hmm. I happened to be down at a little corner drugstore and found out about it by guys talking about maybe they would have to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home and asked what that was about, and then we listened to Roosevelt's speech that night, I recall, and or the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, life changed for everybody, pretty much.
Right.
My uncle, who had been in World War One and had been gassed, mustard gassed,
mm-hmm.
Was called to work. And he was considered, to the point of where he shouldn't be working. And then I thought, wow, that must be something, because my Uncle Jack was called in to help in this war effort.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of was across the board, I think, for kids my age, which was about nine, I guess, we started seeing all these little things show up as far as helping the war effort. My dad went to work for Kaiser Shipyards. My uncle was there. There was this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And after about a year, I guess it was, my family split up. We moved to a little town in southern Oregon, Klamath Falls. And there they had a veterans hospital that they'd opened for guys coming back that had been wounded. And mostly these were people in the Orient, the Far East
mm-hmm.
group, Pacific group. And we did stuff there that I recall. And that's when I would, my mom went back to work, and then as there was such a shortage of guys,
mm-hmm.
all the kids I knew had no fathers. I mean, everybody was split up, so we were all kind of on our own and became the so-called men of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And we did our chores and had little things you had to do. In those days, like my grandkids and even my kids were surprised about saving the tinfoil off of wrappers, cigarette wrappers.
Right.
Making oleomargarine out of little white blocks and mm-hmm. getting the yellow on your hands.
Mm-hmm.
Gas was rationed. Fuel oil was rationed. Everything, meat was rationed. We saved bacon grease and took it down to the butcher, and he put it in a big thing, which was used in munitions.
Mm-hmm.
There were always flags in every window, just about, it seemed like, where the little red, white, and blue symbol with stars on it is the number of people that were serving.
Mm-hmm.
Those were very noticeable. And as I said, my sister was almost 3.5 years, I guess a little over 3.5 years older than I.
Mm-hmm.
And she had obviously at that age become a teenager and kind of was off by herself. But I became very interested in models, airplanes, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
and actually went to work for a man that ran a little bike shop, which also sold models.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that got me interested in model airplanes and making models and doing that. And, of course, all us kids had knew all the statistics now. Instead of baseball players, we knew all this stuff about airplanes, what they did, how many fast they would go, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we had all the latest versions and would compare notes, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Now, was your father with you at this point? Or was
no. He had moved back to Illinois, actually, which was his home.
Okay.
And we were in Southern Oregon,
okay.
my sister and I and my mother.
Okay.
So we were there for some time. We had projects that we would do for the hospital,
mm-hmm.
Which was even, I learned to knit, actually.
Really?
We knitted these little squares.
Mm-hmm.
And then people sewed them squares together that were better than we were and made them into Afghan blankets.
Okay.
And for the soldiers so they could sit outside and have a blanket over their,
mm-hmm.
their legs.
Did your mother work at the hospital?
No, she worked, she was a bank teller. She had done that before my dad and mom got married.
Okay.
And so she went back to the banking business. Primarily, it was all run by women, just about.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was all noticeable, we all knew. But there were very few men except the older ones, and or those disabled.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, even my uncle had been disabled and was working.
Mm-hmm.
So this was kind of commonplace and something we got used to. It wasn't that we didn't have any fun or stuff in those days. We did all kinds of stuff, but primarily on our own
mm-hmm.
initiative. My neighbor friend, I know, we used to really enjoy going out and camping on a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little .22 rifle, and we would go out. He did too, and we'd go out and shoot stuff and live out by ourselves.
Right.
And we were 10, 11 years old, and something you just cringe now.
Mm-hmm.
But this is basically how I grew up, and my mother then, as the war was starting to move down and get a little more
mm-hmm.
In the final stages, we ended up moving back to Portland. And in those days, then she also had started having problems with alcohol herself, so she ended up finally losing a job and moved. That's one of the reasons we moved to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And and some of the people were being repatriated as far as men coming out of the service at that point,
mm-hmm.
starting to come back to jobs. And, of course, the women were losing theirs to the guys that had served. So
right. This
was kind of a standard.
Let me ask you a question about during the war years quickly. Do you remember mm-hmm. any procedures that you had to go through living on the West Coast with the threat of the so-called invasion of the Japanese and things like that?
Actually, I do. Matter of fact, this not too far from where I was at the time, the Japanese, one of the balloons came down, and they sent these balloons all the way across from Japan, and they floated on the jet stream and then mm-hmm. and dropped. And one hit probably 30, 40 miles from my house
mm-hmm.
and started a small fire. They had incendiary bombs on them
mm-hmm.
and started a fire in the forest there. And that was a big, scary thing. And also
right.
the Oregon coast, for whatever reason, got shelled by a submarine. So I think Oregon was one of those, strangely enough, one of the few places that actually was attacked,
mm-hmm.
I guess,
mm-hmm.
other than Alaska and the Aleutians and all that.
Right.
But the other thing that was happening at that time is the airline industry was still needed, but it was kind of fledgling at that time. DC-3s were the primary airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And as the war started tuning down and they were already seeing the the drop in the number of people they required, they let some of the guys out of the Air Corps to become pilots or second pilots on the airliners, because the pilots were getting really old that were still allowed to continue flying in the airline.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, my aunt and uncle ended up taking one in as a boarder because there were very little housing,
mm-hmm.
and they lived fairly close to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And I met a guy that probably had a great influence on me that I didn't know until probably 30 years later,
mm-hmm.
that introduced me to flying.
Okay. Now, had you been interested before this in flying?
Well, and models. And right. I flew models. So we had gas. I had a little gas model. I found an old engine, and we rebuilt it
mm-hmm.
and got it running when I was down in Klamath Falls. And then when we moved back to Portland, there was kind of a place there where I'd lost those friends and those things I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly this young man showed up that was, you know, the old straight, you know, straight teeth and crooked smile kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think was in his 20s at the time, or barely. And he made models, too. So we made a model together, which he primarily did all the good stuff
mm-hmm.
and helped me make it. And I never forget, it was a little P-40 Warhawk with mm-hmm. a big, you know, the shark's tooth on the front,
mm-hmm.
that stuff. But he took me one day and said, come on, I'm going to take you somewhere. And he took me out to this little grass strip next to the big airport and took me up in a PT-19, which was an open cockpit airplane,
mm-hmm.
and threw me in the front seat with a parachute. I could barely see out. We had one of these voice tubes that you holler in.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me up, and we just did everything.
This is your first time flying.
Yeah. And it was just wow. And then after that, he took me up, I don't know, a few more. I seemed like a ton, but it was probably only five or six more times.
Mm-hmm.
And in Piper Cubs, and then again a couple of times in that Fairchild PT-19.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess after doing acrobatics and that kind of thing, I was hooked.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's where I always said that someday I'm going to be a pilot.
Right, right.
So anyway, that's kind of, and you know, in the meanwhile, I was in high school and mm-hmm. doing stuff. And
how old were you when you went on this flight?
My first flight was probably, I guess, 12 or 13.
Okay.
And there's kind of a jumble in there as far as events when they, because it all seems like it kind of moved together.
Yes, sir.
And the same time in there when I was in high school,
mm-hmm.
I moved in with a friend's family
mm-hmm.
Because my mom was having problems, and my sister did the same thing. So
mm-hmm.
we were kind of actually living with another guy in school. And grew up that way and went through high school and
mm-hmm.
played all the sports and did all the stuff he could do.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other thing I remember is even in high school, because I graduated in 49,
mm-hmm.
50 actually, legally 50, but I was through school in 49.
Mm-hmm.
And all our teachers were about 65 or 70.
Wow.
It seemed like, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few others, but young women, a few. But primarily they were older because everything had shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And so they recalled all these teachers. So my idea of teachers in high school especially were all these seniors.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have a greater respect for them.
What kind of student were you?
I did pretty good. I guess, I don't know, I can't even remember the grading system now, come to think of it, but I probably came out with a high B average, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, one of these guys that was my advisor
mm-hmm.
in high school, had me put in for scholarships, and I did win two, and to the University of Oregon, and which were pretty decent scholarships. And I was all set to go to college, and then my mom had a relapse, and her father died back in Illinois, and she asked me to go with her. And so I ended up going with her back to Illinois that first year, so I ended up missing a year of school. And finally, her problem didn't get any better, so I ended up just leaving and going out on my own. And I ended up with this best friend kind of helped me out all the time. He conned me into going back and getting those scholarships. And instead of enlisting in the Navy, which I was going to do then. And as a matter of fact, it was kind of funny because I did try to enlist in the Navy. And I wanted to be a Navy pilot then. And they said, you can't be because you've got these allergies, which I'd been allergic to egg my whole life. So I couldn't take a lot of shots and stuff that you were supposed to take. And
when was this when you tried to enlist in the Navy?
Oh, it was probably 50 or 51.
Okay.
50, I guess.
In Chicago or back in Oregon?
No, back in Oregon.
Okay.
And let's see. Well, it, I mean, it was just a primarily a thing of my good buddy who I lived with, his father and stuff. They supported me, gave me. I went to work for his company for a while till school came, and then I went to school, got an ROTC, which everybody had to do. Although the Navy didn't want me, I didn't get any draft deferment. So you always had to worry about that when you were in college, is if you did bad or got below X grade point, which was basically 2 point, anything below, you started getting in trouble with the draft board. So the other is that I wanted to be an architect at that point, and I couldn't do it because I didn't have enough math to make it in the time frame. So the and that was one of the problems with our seniors in high school, was very few of them were versatile in anything up to basic trig, so you didn't get much above that. So it anyway, I got out of school. I was the first one in my family to have a college degree. My sister had to drop out after 2 years because my mom had spent the money that was left to us for school. So anyway, I started school with $35, and I ended up I think $180 in the hole. And because it was a lot easier, I guess, to get work those days. But I did everything from sample cigarettes, God forbid. Who knew at that point?
You sampled cigarettes.
Yeah, working for R.J. Reynolds.
Okay.
And I got a $25 a month and all the cigarettes I could smoke, which was great. And I was a houseboy at a sorority, which gave me all my meals. I was a house manager in a fraternity, and and that gave me my room. So actually, all I had to do was, and I had two scholarships, and actually I got a third one for playing tennis, so I ended up borrowing $300 every semester, and then I'd pay it back over the summer. And so I basically got out broke, but I still had I'd gotten through and done about everything all the other kids did except have a car.
What year did you graduate?
1955.
Okay. And tell me about the ROTC experience.
Oh, we had an Air Force ROTC, which had the old, what you call pinks. They were the old kind of pink tan pants and the dark top. And we went through and marched a lot, and we had a, which I participated in a, our little rifle, whatever, club,
mm-hmm.
and because I'd learned to shoot when I was teeny.
Right.
And pretty normal. You wander around and supposedly learn everything that's going on, but it's not really mm-hmm. a whole lot other than just basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
how did you like that military discipline and lifestyle?
Well, we didn't have much then. I mean, that wasn't it. The other thing is I think it just our society was just a lot different then. You had
mm-hmm.
more discipline.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I grew up with basically no folks around,
right?
On a regular daily basis. So, I mean, my mom was always there in the evening, and we had food, but also we had to learn to cook. We had to learn to clean up. We had to do that stuff because she was working.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of was a normal thing, I think, more than for kids.
Mm-hmm.
But so actually, it as far as discipline and the things you're doing, that's what you saw in your whole, at least mine, my teen years,
mm-hmm.
is that's what we learned about. That's what we knew. We knew people, the rest of it, service.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a different thing.
Right.
And everybody did their part, as it was always called.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go to the theater on Saturdays and see the newsreels
mm-hmm.
about stuff going on. But that was the only kind of thing you really noticed.
Mm-hmm. Did you have an aspiration to go ahead and get into the service, into the Air Force, as soon as you got out of college, or did you want to use that as maybe a financial thing for yourself?
Well, I didn't have a choice. I mean, I had to report.
Right.
And I got out in school and sometime in June, I guess, 55.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't actually, my class to go in the service wasn't until, because I was accepted for pilot training.
Mm-hmm.
So my class wouldn't start till the following year. So I went in, I believe, the middle of part of January in 56,
okay.
and went through a very basic 1 month of what they call pre-flight, and then went right into pilot training.
Okay. What was that experience like?
Oh, pilot training was great, except we had all these, in those days, your initial primary flying training
mm-hmm.
was handled what they call by contract. So your instructors were contract instructors. They weren't in the service.
Mm-hmm.
They had all been in the service, however, at that point, and most of them were hotshot fighter pilots out of the Navy and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was no exception. He'd fought in the Battle of the Philippine Sea and whatever, and gotten a bunch of zeros and.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys were all heroes to us,
mm-hmm.
especially because we grew up watching them, you know, on the newsreels. So,
right.
It was fun.
Where did this take place?
This was in Malden, Missouri.
Okay.
Boy, a bad spot.
Really?
I mean, there was just nothing around there. We were 150 miles from St. Louis and 150 miles from Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, we had Bald Knob. Places like that in mm-hmm. northern Arkansas, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
A few places over in southern Illinois or not too far from Paducah, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
But there was really zero. So we tried both sides when we got far enough along where we could actually take off a whole weekend.
Mm-hmm.
We tried Memphis, and that wasn't fun for us. And we decided we liked St. Louis better. There was more to do for us to go up there and just visit real restaurants and have real food and listen to real jazz music,
mm-hmm.
that kind of stuff, which somehow I'd ended up being liking jazz. So
okay.
That was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we got through pilot training, and then again, the way the military worked in those days anyway is that everything was graded. Everything you did was a check ride. The check
right.
ride had grades, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You ended up in your class. which there was a morning class and an afternoon class. Half of you went on both sides. And all that meant was you, like I was a green hawk, and then we had green eagles.
Mm-hmm.
And you both flew at opposite parts of the day. And you basically flew for 8 hours, and you had 4 hours of academics.
Mm-hmm.
And that just kind of went on 12-hour days just forever.
Mm-hmm.
And normally we got off Saturdays if we weren't falling behind. Otherwise, we'd had to fly on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have academics on Saturday normally.
Right, right.
But I don't remember now. I got to our instructors were all powerful, and their basic thing was they either put you in fighter training or
mm-hmm.
they put you in, which in those days was jet,
mm-hmm.
and or they put you in multi-engine training, which was reciprocating, which were going to B-25 bomber training.
Mm-hmm.
So I was fortunate enough to get high enough grades and whatever to get selected into the jet school.
Right. Now, let me ask you, how did flying by yourself, how did that feel? Was it natural to you, or did you really have to put a lot of effort into that?
Flying, what you learn real fast, and at least for me, was when you learn to fly, it's like driving a car or riding a bike or anything else. There's a technique to it until you finally get your hand-eye coordination, and in this case, your feet and the rudders and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But and get used to the idea that you can drop like in an elevator and get those kind of things under control, which takes about probably
mm-hmm.
5 or 6 flights. And from then on, it all becomes a mental thing. Because you have to know where you go. You have to look for places you could land if you had an emergency. You have to do whatever. You have to keep looking around for other airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon, that's the hard part. And you think you can do it all by reading the book, and you can't.
Mm-hmm.
I think on my solo ride, I did what they said, which they wouldn't even let you out of sight of the field. You just shoot landings. But my first really solo was... I went up and I thought, well, I'll get ahead of the game. I'll do some acrobatics because
mm-hmm.
I read the book. And I thought I was going to kill myself. I ended up straight down, going too fast,
mm-hmm.
scared, and got out of it. And, of course, I got back, and my instructor looked at me, and he said, you didn't do something dumb, did you?
What was your answer?
Well, I no, sir, but I think I was probably redder than a beet. He knew I was lying.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most everybody did that.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want to admit it.
Right. Did you feel comfortable behind the stick? You know, after you did the book training, you had that down. But you said more by feeling is how you would fly. So did you feel comfortable, or was it?
I felt great. I don't know. It's really difficult to try and explain to someone. I already tried to do this with my wife,
mm-hmm.
and I never could. Even though she was a stewardess in those days, flying is one thing, but being up in a little airplane where you just kind of become part of the whole scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, the airline guy that gave me my first flight,
mm-hmm.
he told me what you call playing with clouds,
mm-hmm.
and you just do acrobatics and get up close to a cloud, and you roll upside down and try and put your head in it.
Okay.
But not the rest of the airplane. I mean, you want to get really close, but you kind of do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just just kind of a freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And you get kind of part of the whole, it seems like you just fit in.
Okay. And at Malden, did you have this feeling, or was it?
Yeah,
later?
I did. When we got to fly, when there were little clouds around, because most of the time they didn't want us messing around until we got our instrument training done. But we all went off and tried to fly formation together and do everything you're not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing is, the only control they had on us is they said, if you screw up, you're not going into fighters.
Okay.
So that was.
That caught your attention.
Yeah, that always got our attention. Mm-hmm. So we kind of, we were right next to the Mississippi River, and we used to roll upside down, open the canopy of the airplane, and throw oranges at barges and stuff. They served us in their mess hall there. They served us these green oranges, and they were just awful. So they were great bombs. So we always thought we were bombing these guys.
Right.
And, of course, I don't imagine we came within a half a mile of them.
Mm-hmm. You never hit anyone.
I don't know. But anyway, I doubt it.
How high up were you when you were dropping the oranges?
Oh, a couple thousand feet, probably.
Okay. How long did the training at Malden last?
It was basically 6 months.
Mm-hmm. And from there, where did you go?
My next base was Laredo, Texas. Mm-hmm. And that was T-33 jet training.
Okay.
And
when did you arrive there? I'm sorry.
Oh, that was still in 56.
Okay.
I think it was around September.
Mm-hmm.
So we lucked out and got in at the tail end of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a real different experience going into the next stage, which was advanced training.
Right.
And it's not so much that it was the jets, although they were really impressive to us after getting out of reciprocating airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But fuel was really, you had to manage everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you move faster, so it just the job became a little faster.
Mm-hmm.
They washed out, I don't remember, right off the bat, we lost 5 or 6 guys just because they had trouble landing because of the difference in speed.
Really? I mean, they were killed.
No. Oh. I mean, they washed them out. They just said, you're done flying.
Okay.
So, and we did have 2 crashes, I think, when I was in my pilot training there.
Mm-hmm.
And, let's see. Yeah, I believe it was 2. And we lost, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 guys just from not being able to handle the training.
Mm-hmm. How did you handle the jet?
I did pretty good. The goal always for us was to graduate high enough to get into fighters.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted, my big dream was to get into F-86s.
Okay.
And I missed it by 1.
Mm.
And so then I had a choice of F-84s, which at that point they were having a lot of engine problems. And my instructor said, why don't you go back and become a T-Bird instructor?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll at least build up a lot of flying time quick.
Mm-hmm.
And because instructors get a lot of flying time. And the Air Force was cutting back on flying a little bit at that point. So I took his advice and did that, and it turned out to be good because the F-84 had real problems, and they were grounded half the time, and all my buddies that went into them just sat around a lot.
Hmm.
So it was tough. But I went to T-Bird training, and what you do there is we went through, I think it was 3-month course, and this time we had our wings. We got our wings at the end of the course.
Okay, in Laredo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I didn't mention is that in those days also we had what they called aviation cadets.
Mm-hmm.
And these were guys primarily that had about 2 years of college, and they wanted to fly, or they couldn't afford school or whatever, but they went into that program and they were treated as cadets until they graduated and earned their wings. And in that time, they got their second lieutenant bars as well as their wings the same day.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, I'd already gotten my second lieutenant bars, and then I got my wings as a student officer.
Mm-hmm.
So they did away with that program not much longer and required everybody to have their 4 years before they could go into pilot training.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I went through the school. It was about a 3-month school. We did everything we did in basic training, I mean advanced training, except we did it all in the back seat.
Right.
So you learned how everything was different, and you got to the point of where you could, by rote, even when you're pulling G's, to just talk and tell people exactly what they should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually a really good job.
Where did this take place?
I had to go back to Laredo. It was one of my only problems.
Okay.
And that's when I learned that you could fry an egg on the wing of an airplane at noon, which we actually have a picture of somewhere.
Oh, you actually did this?
Yes. I think it was 116 or something, and the airplane sitting out there in that sun, that wing gets so hot, you just crack an egg, and it just turns into a nice little round, doesn't run, anything, just sits there like in a skillet.
Mm-hmm.
But Laredo actually turned out to be a pretty fun place. Most everybody, well, I'd say most, about half of us were bachelors.
Mm-hmm.
The other half were young married guys. This is the instructors. Mm-hmm. All the students primarily, very few of them were married. Almost everyone was single. And it was the same old deal. Training is always the same. Air Force is pretty much the same way. You have 12-hour days, and some days you don't work at all. But when you work, you're normally working pretty long hours.
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up living with two other guys, and we rented a house in Laredo and had parties and did everything all the young bachelors do.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one of the highlights of when you're in advanced training is taking your what they call a student cross country, and you have to plan and go fly at least four flights, I think it is, and most of us did five or six. And you have to go to different places, and you tell a student where does he want to end up, and almost everyone wanted to go to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
But you end up things like that, and then you say, okay, then I want you to go to Kansas City. I want you to go to Albuquerque. I want you to go to so-and-so. And then they have to flight plan it, do everything, get everything right, and then you see if they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are at night, some of them are day. If there's weather, we'd usually try and get a guy into at least some real weather.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of business. And we'd usually party at wherever the out end was, whether it was like Vegas or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a group that was going into San Francisco, to actually Hamilton Air Force Base, which was right next to, I guess it's San Rafael. It's right next to Sausalito and the north San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
And neat place. And we started going out there, and then we'd spend an evening in the city, which was really fun. They had all kinds of jazz places and really nice, fun places to go. And that's where I ended up. These guys had met a group of stewardesses.
Mm-hmm.
They were flying for American. There were about, I guess, six of them.
Mm-hmm.
All lived in one flat down in the city. And I got fixed up with one and ended up marrying her.
Hmm.
So
that worked out well for you then?
It was great.
Yes, sir.
But we were talking about getting married and all of that kind of thing. And then the situation, and that was 1958, 59, early. And the military just had lost especially the Air Force, had lost money for almost anything but the Strategic Air Command.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just doing away with fighters right and left. And a bunch of us decided that if we wanted to continue flying fighters, we were going to have to get out and go in the Guard.
Okay.
And that made Fran happy because she thought she'd rather not live a military life,
mm-hmm.
and move around all the time. We'd rather be, and I ended up moving to Fresno, California,
mm-hmm.
where we had a guard unit that a couple of guys that I know had buddies and friends that getting into a guard unit at that point was even hard to do, because you'd have to go interview in the air.
Okay.
And so I passed anyway, and
mm-hmm.
and was accepted into the Guard. And then we ended up, they had F-86s, but the all-weather kind, the interceptor kind.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my, I finally got to fly an 86.
Okay.
But
how was that for you?
It was fine. It, I found, you know, you could get it 35,000-40,000 feet and point straight down, plug in the afterburner,
mm-hmm.
and you sometimes could make it through the speed of sound.
Wow.
But it was really tough.
Uh-huh.
And but I had a really good time in the Guard. It's probably the most professional group of pilots I've ever served with,
mm-hmm.
as far as one small squadron. The guys were just fabulous. And instrument pilots, I literally landed one time at Hamilton Air Force Base absolutely 0-0. I couldn't even taxi.
Really?
It was so bad, they had to come out and find me,
mm-hmm.
and try and tow the airplane off the runway.
Wow.
But
what did you do in the Guard specifically? What were your duties?
Well, I was both, because I had so much T-33 time, T-Bird mm-hmm. time, I was an instructor,
mm-hmm.
instrument instructor, and I also was just a standard pilot. So we flew an air defense mission, and actually we picked up a commitment for standing alert,
mm-hmm.
air defense alert for the West Coast. And the Guard did that at those times. And actually, we went on active duty for one day,
mm-hmm.
24 hours active duty when we served. And, of course, I had a job, so I worked. I would sit alert at night. So I'd go in there at 6 in the evening and get off at 6 in the morning. And normally, we'd get a practice scramble or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we had to jump out of bed, throw everything on,
mm-hmm.
roar to the airplane, and get airborne in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and surprisingly, you can do that.
Okay.
But you normally slept in a flight suit,
mm-hmm.
just pull boots on and a zipper.
Right.
And the ground crew help get everything going mm-hmm. as you're jumping in and strapping in. But,
mm-hmm.
but we did that, and everything was fine, and I was working for Procter & Gamble and working in their promotion department,
mm-hmm.
and my boss was in L.A. I used to actually fly a Guard bird down there and land at L.A. International and have somebody from the company come pick me up, and then we'd go in, and when we had our meetings, it was really kind of keen, because everybody else would walk in suits, and I'd walk into the hotel in a flight suit
mm-hmm.
and then change for the meeting,
mm-hmm.
but I did that for a couple of years, and in 61, I can't remember the month, but in 61 is when the Russians decided they were going to close off Berlin.
Yes, sir.
And so the military had very few active duty fighters, and what they did have, they were sitting nuclear alert, so they had hardly anybody else that knew the air-to-air program or anything else, so they
mm-hmm.
they activated a bunch of us on the Guard,
mm-hmm.
and lots of us ended up either briefing to get people across to France, primarily is where they ended up going, France and Germany,
mm-hmm.
but get them there or somewhere, and they had, of course, high flight, which was over the Greenland, and it would go McGuire, and you'd get somehow to McGuire, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and then you'd go to Newfoundland, then Saunderstrom, Greenland, and then Prestwick, Scotland, and then you'd finally get across to wherever you were in the continent,
mm-hmm.
and everybody had to wear poopy suits and that kind of stuff to do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That only lasted probably 4.5 months, and I went back to work, and everybody kind of normaled it out,
mm-hmm.
and then we started getting more problems coming around the world at that point, and
mm-hmm.
and the preludes to the Cuban thing was
mm-hmm.
was the primary thing was putting these nuclear missiles in Turkey and this kind of stuff around the continent of Europe, and the Russians, and Khrushchev had just taken over and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we got reactivated again. This time they activated us for a minimum of 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really couldn't do much about it. And we ended up in Florida, mm-hmm. at MacDill in Tampa, Florida, which just happened to be about 30 miles from where Fran grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of neat for us in a way, because we met the grandparents, and although we'd met them, I mean, we lived right there, so this was fun. And the kids could grow up knowing their Grammy and Papa and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got there, I had so much T-bird time. Again, I ended up being a T-bird instructor, as well as checking out in the F-84F, which was the airplanes that we brought in. And so I started doing both.
Mm-hmm.
The Cuban crisis hit, which was kind of a fiasco, actually, from what they say on all the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But
how so?
Oh, I was just to give you a quick example. I was flying T-33s. The thing had started, and we found out there were missiles down there, and we had Tampa was about ready to sink because we had so many fighters there. Everything in the inventory, practically. We had 175 or something F-84s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many guard units they recalled and everything else. They were all in the guard. And we had a few F-100s. I think one wing of them, which was about 60, I guess. And reconnaissance airplanes, all kinds of junk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was down doing a test hop in a T-bird. And we had an engine change, and it's one of those things you just get used to. And I was walking back, and it was fairly late in the afternoon, and I was walking back to our squadron, which was probably a quarter of a mile. And I saw this big red book laying on the ramp. And I walked over, and it says top secret on it.
Mm-hmm.
I pick it up. It's the operations plan for Cuba.
Hmm.
And, oh, boy. So I pick it up, and I didn't really look at it. Of course, I peeked a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and I walked into the air division, which was next to our squadron, where the bosses worked,
mm-hmm.
and I walked in, and I said, who do I turn this thing into? I don't know what else to do, and they all gasped and said, how in the hell did you find that?
Mm-hmm.
I said, it's laying on the ramp. Oh, God. And then they said, are you cleared for top secret? And I said, not that I know of, and they said, well, you are now,
mm-hmm.
and so that's... I got involved in that, and then suddenly after they made me, they cleared my clearance, and then they made me and put me in charge of ferrying photos.
Okay.
Which all our recce guy, you remember all those photos about the...
Yes, sir.
The SA-2s and all that,
mm-hmm.
junk.
Mm-hmm.
So I started ferrying those up to Washington and our primarily to South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
where our 9th Air Force headquarters was.
Mm-hmm.
But we had so many airplanes, and nobody knew how anything worked. The guard is kind of unique in that, first place, we were on the bottom of the list for any of the uniforms or anything. So guard pilots had stitched up flight suits. They wore funny patches. They had brown boots instead of black boots, which weren't shined. I mean, we flew with Chippewa boots, which we flew because we were flying over the Sierras all the time,
mm-hmm.
when I was in our guard unit. So we had those insulated boots,
mm-hmm.
which we couldn't get good ones from the military. So we ended up with this ragtag militia running around. It was kind of funny. But LeMay came down to visit us, and guys jumped up. He looked around, just about died.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was your impression of LeMay?
He was just like his picture. I had met him later when I was an attaché in Portugal,
mm-hmm.
but and he'd already retired and whatever. And I asked him about that, matter of fact. But he was a tough-looking guy. He had that cigar always sticking out of his mouth, and
mm-hmm.
he kind of walked around like a bulldog. He wasn't a real big guy,
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of funny, but he was impressionable. Everybody knew about him and knew who he was, and we all had respect for him because he really stood up for the Air Force. But it was funny because then suddenly, within a week, every one of us had new flight suits. We had patches. We had all the stuff, black boots. It just nobody ever really said much about it other than that happened. But
that was LeMay's doing.
Yeah. I'm sure it was. Or whoever, he had an entourage of guys with him, so all kinds of generals and everyone. So someone somehow found flight suits and all the rest so we could at least look decent. All of a sudden, the whole thing was over.
Right.
I'd checked out in the F-84 and had a little bit of experience, so I was a spare because I hadn't had that much experience as far as the weaponry they were going to drop. It just suddenly pretty much was over. The other ironic thing is we were all let off alert, everything else. We all went home. We picked up our wives where they were out, did this whole thing. And the next day, Kennedy gets on the news and says, "We've just concluded this agreement and the war is over."
Mm-hmm.
But it had been over for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first time I realized some of these guys fudge a little bit from the political side.
Mm-hmm. How did you think the missile crisis was handled overall?
Oh, it probably would have been a real mess because we didn't know how to work together with people. I guess the Air Force went their way, the Army went their way, the Navy went their way. There wasn't any real training programs or anything. I mean, this war right now is probably the epitome of how guys learn how to cooperate and work together.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as those days, even within the Air Force, we had the bomber forces, we had the fighter forces, we had the training forces, and never the twain shall meet. You just really never knew anybody or did anything with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're even based together.
Mm-hmm.
So it was light years different. And the training itself in those days was very, very limited to just exactly what your role was.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, if you were a interceptor pilot, that's all you did.
Mm-hmm.
You had no idea of working with anybody else, what their mission was, anything. You just knew yours by heart. And that's a lot of the people that we ended up later then going into war in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So there was somehow trying to integrate all these guys from the bomber forces. A pilot's a pilot, so they started just assigning people to Vietnam, and then you'd end up with a guy out of the bomber command, you'd end up with a guy that was an interceptor pilot, you'd end up with a guy that was a reconnaissance pilot, never dropped a bomb in his life, and just took pictures.
Mm-hmm.
You'd end up with all these guys. They went through about a four-month training program, and they found themselves in Vietnam.
Right.
So we were short-sighted, I guess. Everyone had their little niches, that sort of thing. And, of course, we were happy within those and did our things, but we didn't realize until actually we got into the combat, at least I didn't, how important it was to do things that we didn't do.
Why did that happen?
I think primarily because we just got fixated on the nuclear war.
Okay.
And we worried about nuclear bombers coming over here, so we really wanted to shoot them down. So that's our interceptor force. And we really worried about the huge mass of the Soviet Army to come roaring across the fold the gap into Germany, and we needed to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
So the way you stop them when you're littler than they are is nukes.
Mm-hmm.
So primarily, fighter pilots learn how to drop nukes and fly low level, high speed.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a huge group of people that learned that job. The training people were in the middle and probably, as it turned out, had more overall experience because you did more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of funny. We had a few TAC forces that were actually, I guess what you'd call fighter bombers and air-to-air, but it was kind of divided up in those days, too, for you were either an air-to-air pilot or you were a bomber, an attack pilot. So everything got too much specialized where you, and a lot of that, too, I'm not just saying it was leadership. I'm saying it was the way airplanes were designed, what they did.
Right.
That sort of thing. So,
why do you think it changed?
Oh, I think a lot of it came out of the guys that served in Thailand, quite a group of guys, even out of my own squadron. A lot of us all at least made colonel. Some of us that were there made general. Follow on, when they finally got the younger, and we were mostly guard guys, and you never promoted a guard guy to colonel, to even colonel or general, hardly, and in those days. And so the guys that came in behind us a little bit, the guys that served in the at U-Bahn, for example, in the 8th Attack Fighter Wing, which is what we turned the field over to when we left, the Wolf Pack became well-known. It was Robin Oles and Chappie James and Bill Kirk and all these guys, and they all made general. And so they became the leadership, and they knew how things were and the problems that we'd seen. So I think we had a huge change of leadership. And I don't know, now that I've lived a long time and kind of like to be a historian, I've looked back, and it's kind of, I think it's almost like John Adams' brother Brooks came up with this big thing about our whole world, our whole civilization is always run on a sine curve. It's just kind of ups and downs. And the leaders are developed on the ups, and then it gets bad, and then it kind of spawns a new group of people that overthrow the leader and whatever, and they become leaders. And it kind of does work that way. But I think that's what happened. Because the guys that were the three stars in Desert Storm were guys that I knew as captains and majors.
Right.
So they were the ones that saw how some of the ways we were taught and trained was wrong.
And they were able to make the changes later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, when I got out of my second tour and everything, we started working on the particular job I had. We started working on that policy. But it wasn't until the early 70s that this really, we could... The younger guys got strong enough to influence.
Okay. So after your time here in Florida, what happened? Did you re-enlist in the Air Force, or did you stay in the Guard for a while longer?
Well, I decided that I'd already given a long time, and I might as well stay in. And then they started throwing you little things, like they said. We all checked out in the F-84, and we became combat ready and did our whole job there in the F-84. And I was a pretty good gunner. And they kept saying, some of the senior guys would say, you probably should go to the weapons school. You're natural at this and whatever. So I kind of thought, well, maybe I got a chance. And by that time, we'd had our... You know, kids growing up, Fran was there. She got where it's actually a good life. It's not an easy life, but it's a lot of camaraderie with the people that you're with all the time.
Right.
And so we were there, I guess, when was it? A year and a half to 2 years after Cuba. And we heard we might be getting a new airplane. And that's when the Air Force decided, and this was part of it too, but this is when they decided that we should have these multi-purpose airplanes. that we needed an airplane that could be an interceptor, we needed a bomber, and that's what McNamara's big thing was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the F-111 was a big failure. It was too big, it was underpowered, it had all kinds of problems. It ended up, finally, when they put it into a mission they could do, it was a good airplane, but but it wasn't this all where they wanted them to land on carriers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said the F-4 can be modified to be pretty good, and it would do a lot of jobs well. It could carry anything we had. We can make it a nuke bomber. We can make it a air-to-air airplane. We can make it a attack airplane. So the F-4 kind of came out with those credentials.
Mm-hmm.
So it was originally called the F-110. And we happened to be in obsolete airplanes that with a lot of people with a lot of experience and a lot of gunnery experience, we just didn't have very good airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere, someone decided we ought to be the guys that get into the new airplanes first.
Okay.
And, of course, that's when we found out we were going to get F-4s, and we started out with Navy ones that they had to put a stick in the back seat and check some guys out, and then I ended up going to Tucson, Arizona,
mm-hmm.
at Davis-Monthan for our checkout.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we got married up with our Gibbs, they call them. They were pilot system operators, and of course that in the military becomes an acronym, PESO.
Mm-hmm.
And the backseaters were actually pilots. They weren't navigators.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't like that title very well. So we just started calling them guys in back.
Mm-hmm.
So it became GIFs and Gibbs, guys in front, guys in back.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stuck. And it's kind of, it really is funny because then that became a worldwide, just zing.
Oh, yeah?
Like these names just come out about different things. But
mm-hmm.
Regardless of what you're supposed to call them, they just end up what the guys want to call them.
Right.
So we did that.
This is 1964?
Yeah.
Okay.
And in between all this stuff is when they were trying to bring us up to what they call worldwide status, which means you have to go through water survival schools, you have to go through the escape and evasion
mm-hmm.
survival schools, that stuff. And so sprinkled in here, during this last year, I guess about 64, all this happened. I went through STED, which in those days was our survival school.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone in our unit literally went through. We just owned the thing for a while they hustled us all through the school.
Mm-hmm.
And Sea Survival, we went through that a couple of times. Everybody did.
Mm-hmm.
And which turned out to be one of the best things, I guess, that ever happened, although it was miserable.
Why is that?
Oh, it was either cold, they put you in these poopy suits, and they always leaked. They gave us a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with this ice water from your knees down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sweat in them so bad, too, and that fills them up. But flying an airplane with one is really awful.
Mm-hmm.
But
why was it one of the better experiences?
Oh, because as it turned out later in Southeast Asia, your sanctuary was the water.
Mm-hmm.
If you could make it to the water, you're probably going to live. So everyone was tuned to that.
Mm-hmm.
And they all knew they could get out of an airplane and get in the water. You didn't hit the ground so hard or end up in 300 feet of jungle canopy.
Mm-hmm.
It was sure better to be out there in the water.
Right.
And so that became an important thing.
Okay.
The survival school was a good experience after the fact. Nobody liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us that had grown up when we were kids out and camping,
mm-hmm.
Really kind of liked it, the outdoors, as far as the trek part of it.
Mm-hmm.
We had to walk, I don't remember what it was now, 35 miles, I guess, in this horrible mountain terrain,
mm-hmm.
up and down, cold weather, whatever, no fires, and get to a spot by compass.
Mm-hmm.
And you did it in groups of two. Well, those are, actually, they became kind of funny. Some of the stories about people at STED were always famous. But other people actually dropped out and chose not to fly because they didn't. It just scared them to death.
Wow.
And
how did you do?
Oh, I liked it. Other than in this judo whatever training that I never had done.
Mm-hmm.
This guy that was a good buddy of mine actually, he was a football player for Northwestern. I got paired up with. I couldn't throw him over my shoulder if I had to, but he could pick me up like a feather.
Mm-hmm.
And the instructor used to holler at him, quit laying me down, throw me down like mm-hmm. he's supposed to. Well, he did one day and gave me the fake knee, except he didn't fake it, and he broke a rib.
Mm.
So I ended up with a tape rib for most of my experience there.
Mm.
But we learn knife fighting, all this kind of junk, which actually I think it gave you a lot of confidence in case you ever got in a spot you knew where to stick the knife, that, where it wouldn't make a guy yell out loud,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of stuff. But the real sobering thing, too, is our escape and evasion part of it, which we literally got captured by Russians who were all dressed in Russian uniforms, spoke
mm-hmm.
Russian, had a couple of Orientals with them
mm-hmm.
to make it, throw it in. We were captured, stripped of our clothes totally. I mean, we were naked jaybirds,
mm-hmm.
threw a black sack over your head, and threw you in these little, about 5 foot by 5 foot cells,
mm-hmm.
and with a butt can, as I call them, but one of those big old cans that was your latrine, and that's all you had.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd call you out, and you'd hear all this noise going on and beating people and this kind of stuff, and it just you start conjuring up all this stuff
mm-hmm.
that's happening. And of course, it wasn't, but we thought it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer it went, the more it went, the more you started believing it.
Right.
And then you were taken out to be interrogated, and you hear women's voices and stuff, and here you are, and you're all together with a black sack over your head trying to seem like you're normal.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys whacking you on the arms and whacking you in the butt and whatever with these little, like, riding crops.
Mm-hmm.
And they did smart, and asking you questions. And then they'd sit you down on, like, a little milking stool,
mm-hmm.
Which was a one-legger. And if you did anything, you'd fall over if they pushed you.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd interrogate you and ask you all this stuff. Well, we'd been through what you're supposed to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how you start changing. And the guy said, if you're going to change from the serial number and all that, then tell them lies. So... Boy, I told the biggest lies in the world, and I just lied away. And then they said, great, you're a friend of the people and whatever, and they sent me back to my cell.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, boy, I'm good. And about 10 minutes later, they came and got me, you lied!
Mm-hmm.
And they showed me at that point. They had a picture of my wife. They had stuff, a dossier.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, my God. And it looked really... Suddenly, it became kind of real.
Mm-hmm.
And then they threw me in one of these little bitty boxes. It's obviously, they're not big enough to get in, but they somehow get you in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't help me with my rib either. But they do that stuff. And finally, you're getting to the point of where you tell more lies. And then
mm-hmm.
You just keep up the lying, and they keep catching you, and you keep doing it again. But it... That's actually kind of what really happened then later in Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
But we also learned the whole thing was just kind of a, oh boy, it's over. And then we all went down, had a big steak dinner at Harold's Club, whatever, a big prime rib, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was all happy. And then I got back to my room and they said, you're staying here. And for another... week to 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up going through some kind of a, at that time it was all classified, but what they do is teach you the TAP code and all kinds of code stuff,
mm-hmm.
how to write letters, how to do all this stuff in case you ever captured.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a kind of a two sides to it. But first you think, oh boy, I'm all being prepared. And then they think, wait a minute, maybe they'll figure since I'm prepared, they'll send you into a bad place.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I went through that, and I had to write letters to a post office box for a couple of years until I went to Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And try and keep this ability to do this stuff.
Right.
And it's kind of the, as it turned out, it's kind of the same thing as the, I think the guy that invented the tap code in the, as far as our own prisoners,
mm-hmm.
had been through this school too, and he knew a lot better than I did, because
mm-hmm.
I didn't keep up with it as I should have.
Mm-hmm.
But, so anyway.
How long did your time in Arizona last in total?
Well, when I, pilot, I mean, just to check out the F-4 was short. It was, a couple months.
Okay.
Probably 60 days, 50 days. But, we did most of the basic missions, without heavy gunnery or air-to-air.
Mm-hmm.
We went back to MacDill to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was picked to be an instructor, and I had to, another guy and I had to go out and get, I think we had to have 50 hours as a first pilot in the airplane before they could make us an instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went out and just flew a couple of weekends just all around the country trying to get time.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're flying in the F-4?
Yeah, in the F-4.
Okay.
And this is, STAD and those schools were all before I got in the F-4.
Okay.
So that was pre-Arizona, actually.
Okay.
And once we got in the F-4, then it was just everyone was hell-bent on getting time
mm-hmm.
and getting through all the stuff and getting combat ready, which meant everybody had to qualify in gunnery, everybody had to qualify in air-to-air gunnery, everybody had to qualify in low-level navigation, everybody had to qualify in the nuke deliveries. We had to do all the missions now. So everyone just flew for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, I probably had maybe 200 hours in the airplane, and I was probably one of the high guys by the time I actually went to Yuban. But,
okay.
But,
so you went back down to MacDill.
Yeah, we went back to MacDill at home and did all our stuff, and
mm-hmm.
and we were on our regular gunnery range, and that's how we learned to bomb in that airplane and how to do rockets and how to do all the same stuff we'd been doing
mm-hmm.
in the F-84. And F-4 is a pretty good airplane. It's a different airplane to fly, and we didn't have a gun
mm-hmm.
in those days. And once in a while, they'd hang a gun underneath, which they came out with at the last minute, but we could go shoot the Gatling gun that we had then in the Su-20, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
that shot 20 millimeters at such a high rate,
mm-hmm.
which was great, except you couldn't use it air-to-air because we didn't have a computing sight. It was the old Navy sight. So the airplane was prepared quickly. We learned a lot of missions, all of which weren't very well.
Mm-hmm.
They still wanted us to concentrate on the low-level navs and the nuke deliveries, which I can understand that, but it was our primary mission was going to Europe and dropping a nuke on the bad guys.
Right.
And or China, because we did both ways.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the emphasis, and I had heard anyway in this school that Vietnam's a mess,
mm-hmm.
and they all said you're going to end up there,
mm-hmm.
and I believe them, but it's one of those where you don't have to believe them, why, and I didn't get back into that business at all too much. We're just kind of trying to learn the airplane,
right?
And suddenly then it's kind of like that little story I did. I was sitting in the squadron as a scheduling officer, and a buddy of mine walks in and says, hey, guess what? We're going to go to Thailand. And then our ops officer came in and says, shut up. You can't tell anybody. Your wives, nobody. This is a secret. It's TS, you know.
Uh-huh.
And what kind of stupid stuff is that?
Mm-hmm.
But we said, what's our mission? And they said, you're going to give air support for the 105s that are going to be there.
Okay.
And we thought, oh, boy. We're going to get our MiG. You know? And so we all went out and started, I started talking to the guys about scheduling air-to-air and doing all this.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh. We can't do that. We still got to concentrate on nuke deliveries.
Hmm.
And we thought, oh, come on. But anyway, that's kind of how it all started.
Okay. What did you know about what was happening in Southeast Asia, about American policy there?
Not a whole lot. I'd heard some stuff. And actually, in this little school I went through, I learned a lot more than it didn't make sense until a little later, actually,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the things I learned. But
mm-hmm.
I had learned at that time about DM, about some of the guys that the U.S. had picked as leaders for South Vietnam, and they actually were kind of like picking a guy in one of these tribal chieftains in Africa
mm-hmm.
and paying him a lot of money and expecting him to do what you want. He does what he wants.
Right.
And so it was kind of a mess, and we knew it was a mess, but we just never, at least I never did really think, you know, I was in Florida. Why would they move us all the way to Southeast Asia?
Mm-hmm.
That's 12 time zones
mm-hmm.
or whatever, 8, I guess. And but suddenly it happened. So we were all running around getting excited, trying to figure out what we were doing. And we were supposed to keep all this a secret.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife came home from a coffee one day, and the wing commander's wife had told him. And everyone was in trouble.
So much for top secret.
Oh, yeah. Well, the wing commander's wife knows everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then the wives knew, but they were trying to keep quiet because they said it could hurt people if they did this, and they had these big stories. So
mm-hmm.
everybody tried to play it. So
mm-hmm.
we scrambled around and flew, and got combat ready and had to even get our ORI, our readiness inspections and that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the first guys to go were our sister squadron, the 45th, and they left, I think, April, something like that, of 65.
Mm-hmm.
And we went on, they were going to stay for 90 days, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up going and got there in July of 65.
Mm-hmm.
And they had actually stayed a little longer. We flew squadron airplanes from MacDill nonstop to Hawaii, and then we went from Hawaii, and we were supposed to go nonstop to the Philippines, and they ran out of tankers, so we couldn't get enough gas, and we stopped at in the Marianas at Guam,
mm-hmm.
and then flew to the Philippines, and the following day, then we were transported by C-130 up to Yuban.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel going into a war zone?
Oh, it is kind of funny. I think it affects you, but you don't really. This whole thing was, it starts affecting you because Fran and I talked about it, and we mm-hmm. thought, when are you leaving? And finally came time to leave, and we thought, I don't think we want to take the kids out there to the base and watch us take off, because
mm-hmm.
it means that, what if you don't come back?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like you're taking off and you might not come back.
Right.
On the other hand, I was gone all the time for these temporary duty things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just one of those, hey, I've got to go temporary duty, only this one's a little longer. And okay, I mean, the kids didn't worry about it at all. So we left them there when we left. And Fran had a babysitter, and we just, or I think her folks came by or something, but she just came out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's photographers all over the place taking our picture. And I remember looking around on the airplane and kind of looking at this group of people, and there were crowds hanging around. And I thought, yeah, this is kind of funny. Here we're going to this secret place, and the news people are out there taking pictures. Even one of the wives had some kind of a sign, don't go to war or something. And that disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And I said my goodbyes to Fran, climbed in the airplane, we took off.
Hmm.
And I didn't see her again until November 22nd, I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
And our deployment is long, as you can imagine. These
mm-hmm.
these are 10-hour flights.
Yes.
I did lose an engine. We had an oil pump break about 800 miles out of Hickam, out of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And my wingman and he had to stay with me, and we dropped down altitude a little bit. Notice the F-4 was a new airplane, a good airplane, and
mm-hmm.
the other engine, just no problem.
Mm-hmm.
But we got there, and we got a couple hours, what we call our freedom time, and ran over and had a Mai Tai and did that kind of stuff in Hawaii and
mm-hmm.
ran around looking at stuff because most of us had never been there.
Mm-hmm.
And they put us into crew rest, which means take a sleeping pill
right.
and go to bed. And nobody slept, hardly. I mean, you just don't do that anyway. It was kind of a, okay. And half of us, I didn't take one, I don't believe. We had a test program on go, no go,
mm-hmm.
and the go pills, dexedrine, which I guess now is what, amphetamines,
mm-hmm.
drugs, and those things, your eyes get a fixed stare and you can't do anything,
mm-hmm.
and you want to dig holes or do anything, but trying to then sleep in the middle of that was
right.
just impossible.
Right.
And we were supposed to go 12 hours, sleep 12 hours, go 12 hours, and
mm-hmm.
take the Nebutals or whatever the other one was, Seconal. And so we just basically proved it didn't work for us, and
mm-hmm.
so I never did use them. We all carried them. But,
so you did not really use them at all?
No. I never did. I mean, we even flew 9-hour missions in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
But... you're pumped up enough without worrying about giving yourself extras.
Right, right. Okay, sir, when you arrived in Ubon, what were your first impressions of the airbase?
Well, we got there in the afternoon,
mm-hmm.
fairly late. I don't know, after 2 o'clock, probably something like that. When we got off the airplane... we had a waiting line of guys that were going to get on it.
Mm-hmm.
These were people out of the 45th Squadron that we had known. And a lot of them just kind of got in a file, mostly, which were the backseaters,
mm-hmm.
and just getting on the airplane, and they were getting ready to leave. And it just seemed kind of odd because we didn't have kind of a big reunion with them.
Mm-hmm.
And... first thing we'd noticed was our little squadron building, and it's just kind of a look around and you see a base, and it didn't look anything like a real Air Force base.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very small ramp on the south end, I guess it was the southwest end of the field,
mm-hmm.
and there was one hangar and a bunch of airplanes sitting out front, and the airfield itself was... to the east, and it was just out in the middle of a rice paddy.
Hmm.
And there was, it smelled, it's one of those smells you smell when you get somewhere, you just kind of all of a sudden take a breath and you realize it has a distinct odor.
Mm-hmm.
And it smelled. And we looked around, it was real hot, there were a lot of puffy clouds, kind of reminded us of MacDill because
mm-hmm.
it was that late afternoon. Thunderstorms popping up,
mm-hmm.
and you could see actually even rain a distance away coming out of a couple of the thunderclouds, and that's kind of typical of MacDill. And by the time we kind of got organized and were standing around waiting to get our junk off the airplane, we heard that Dick Kern, who was a guy in our squadron,
mm-hmm.
had been shot down. He and Ross Faubert, who were good friends, had been shot down by the first SAM.
Okay.
And that was not real good news. And then we started asking what had gone on, what had happened. This was our guys from the 47th Squadron.
Mm-hmm.
They went over, I think there were 8 people or 10 people, something like that. Our commander, ops officer, a lot of the senior guys went over. And they went to do lesson one to see what it was like flying in with other pilots that were flying in combat that knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So they were there for the advance team, and everyone started asking what happened, and we finally ended up getting a few of the guys that we knew that were the regular pilots, not the bosses, and they told us, they were just sitting there shaking their heads, and they told us this just horror story of our, as it turned out, we had our squadron commander, our ops officer, who was the second guy in charge, the 45th squadron commander, and another guy. They were flying around together, which is probably not not a smart thing to do, is put all that, the bosses together. They were up north flying around over the northern part of Vietnam, way west, just above the Black River. And not Hanoi, but the other quarter ways from Hanoi.
Yes, sir.
But they were flying around basically on the tops of clouds, wispy clouds. Well, nobody had ever shot a SAM at us before. But this was the first one. And, of course, it came right out, boiling out of the clouds, and there was no chance to do anything. And we didn't have any electronic countermeasures or anything in those days to tell us it was even fired. So, and they were in close formation because they'd been in and out of weather. And that's another thing you'd never do. You'd always fly in a combat spread or something. So we were just sitting around saying that couldn't have happened. And it was, it did happen, because then we found out the other airplanes actually even got some collateral damage. And because this thing blew up right in the middle of them, and he happened to be the number two man, which was on one side of the formation. So he took the direct hit. The commander's airplane, the flight leader's airplane, and a couple of the, one of the other airplanes actually took some damage. And they, one of them had to actually stop at Udorn, which was on the way back, right on the border, just south of Vientiane, Laos. And to check for battle damage, make sure he wasn't leaking fuel. He thought his, he'd lost fuel, but he just lost a gauge. And so we got our stuff and were trying to be ushered through the squadron building, which had been taken over by us. And I remember the 47th Squadron, the 15th TAC Fighter Wing was one of those that was developed early in the war, that in the World War II. It was one of the original old squadron wings. It was stationed in Hawaii. And if I'm sure you probably don't even remember, but there was a cartoon character called Little Abner. And he lived in Dog Patch, and they had all this stuff, and they made, he, Al Capp, who was the guy, made these cartoon characters. Ours happened to be a turnip termite, which you'd have to kind of know the whole story of the cartoon to to get the drift. But still, it's a bug, and it was sitting on this silly circle, green and silver and whatever, and this turnip termite was there. And our back, the one backseater had already pulled this sign out. He'd had painted by the ties of our squadron's insignia and stuck it on top of the roof. And we looked around, and there's bugs everywhere, and you could hear the noise, and it stunk, and we looked around and thought, well, maybe this is kind of fits in. And so they finally got us bunked down, and we moved into hooches, which is an experience. It's, hooches are basically open buildings with two roofs on them, and the sides are primarily screen. And fans in there, and there's no air conditioner or whatever, and basic light bulbs running down the ceiling. But we had, I guess the rooms were about 15 by 15, and we had two racks, which would be double bunks, metal, kind of narrow, maybe the 3.5 feet ones, something like that. And these metal, gray metal Air Force lockers, which we had almost everywhere, all the places had them, and then a foot locker. And that was our home, and we went in and dumped our stuff, what we could, and stuck it in the locker, and everyone kind of got acclimated and started looking around and said, where's the John? And it was still an open shed privy, basically, but just larger. I think it was six-holer or something like that. And there weren't any paved streets. It was just all red dirt. And the sidewalks and stuff were basically these, they looked like ladders, you know, the, mm-hmm. I call them behind the bar things, whatever. But I worked as a bartender for a while, and behind the bar you have these slats that you walk around on. So if you break glasses or anything, it's underneath. It's
yes,
not
sir.
On the thing. But that was our sidewalks. And mm-hmm. We had a meeting and got together real quick and said, okay, we're going to get organized. And we didn't want to get organized. We were tired.
Mm-hmm.
We were mad about hearing about what was going to happen. We knew we were going to have a day and a half to get ready before we started flying.
Mm-hmm.
And but our guy said, no, we had to do this first. And I was a scheduling officer, so we had to come up with a mock schedule. And I had to go learn all the system. And we had our little command post. And, of course, those for those that don't know it, the Air Force runs what they call frag orders, fragmentation
mm-hmm.
orders.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you come out with a mission, it was on these fragmentation orders that come out, and they were all coded. And they have to be translated, and then there's frequencies, there's call signs, there's all the stuff that you would be doing, the targets, the alternate targets, the second alternate target, that kind of
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The ordnance that would be used, all that stuff comes floating in from, in this case, it was coming out of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to learn how to do that, and we'd get them together and how we print a schedule, and we had to do our own because nobody had copiers or anything. So we came up with a, I can't even remember what they called it now, but it was one of those where you have ink on a roller and you roll them out.
A mimeograph machine?
Well, I guess it isn't even, it was something else. I can't remember, but it,
mm-hmm.
old. And we had radios, and we had to trade all the stuff and set up our own radio frequencies and
mm-hmm.
stuff and make sure the antenna worked on the roof. And because everybody took their stuff with them. This was all called mobility gear.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of got the layout of the land, decided who was going to do what, who was going to fly what day, and come out with schedules. And we got our flight gear all set up and got our harnesses fixed and got our survival gear squared away and our helmets and what we would do, and then got a couple of briefings. And the next day was kind of the same thing. It was just all briefing about where things were, and if there were any friendlies. We learned suddenly there that we had guys in Laos, we had guys in all over the place,
mm-hmm.
and what the Navy was doing, and they just basically gave us a quick rundown.
What did they tell you specifically about operations in Laos? Do you remember?
No, not at that time. It was just we've got friendlies there. They were primarily run rescue operations out of there, and
mm-hmm.
some of them speak English, so you don't have to worry. Some of them we think are Thais. They fly out of there. We knew the Thais flew up to Vientiane all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we just knew them, and we found out what kind of airplanes were where, because we hadn't really been briefed to any extensive which bases had which 105 units, and these were... Everybody there was on these 90-day rotationals at
mm-hmm.
this time.
Mm-hmm.
The guys out of Okinawa, 105s, and 105s out of Japan
mm-hmm.
were rotating in, and they were rotating on a 30-day basis because they'd come in, fly, just fly, 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 and then go right back, and they were sitting nuclear alert.
Mm-hmm.
So they were going home and then sitting alert for a week, and seeing their family for a week, turn around and come back.
Right.
Almost that fast. So, and we found out we weren't going to be all air-to-air guys either. We were going to do mostly bombing.
Okay.
And that kind of made everybody mad. But we hadn't really heard anything that was going on because they just didn't share it in
mm-hmm.
those days either, even though our intelligence people got some of it. They didn't brief us because we weren't supposed to know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a quick day. We learned we had a mess hall. That was the only place we had to eat. We learned we got $1.90 a day per diem,
mm-hmm.
and that was to cover our expenses.
Okay.
And while we were away, our families got nothing different. They just continued getting regular pay, the rest of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
was the $1.90 adequate?
Well, not at all. I mean, what can you do with $1.90?
Yeah.
And military officers normally don't get free meals at a mess hall. You normally have to pay a surcharge.
Mm-hmm.
So that basically covered our surcharge for about a week.
Okay.
But other than that, it was something. So we got all settled in, finally figured out what we were doing, got our clothes settled, found out what we had. We also got our stuff that had come up from Clark that we had shipped probably a month earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That was our mobility gear, and we didn't realize they were actually going to ship it. Because people, when you had these mobility gear things, you had to have six pair mm-hmm. of underwear, six pair of socks, underwear, shorts,
mm-hmm.
whatever, a couple of just specific things. So nobody put anything good in them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it all showed up, and we had it, and had been out and sitting in a field at Clark in the Philippines and gotten all wet.
Mm.
So we had this moldy junk show up,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty bad because we didn't bring a lot with us.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of room in an F-4 to carry anything. We just
right.
stuffed it in by the side of an ejection seat.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically got there with not much. And finally got squared away, and we're used to doing this anyway. So we got square and figured out who was going to fly and whatever. And
what was morale like?
Pardon me?
What was morale like?
Oh, everybody was, we wanted to get our MIGs, and we were going to do good, and we were all figured we'd won the bombing thing on our ORI. Our squadron was the best bombers, we thought, so we thought we were going to be good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the thing. And then I think I didn't get to fly for 2 days, I believe, because I was the scheduler, and our flight somehow ended up, it was either the second or third day by the time I got to fly. And we flew two flights at the same week.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we A and B flight would fly one day, or they'd fly, what was it, 3 days in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd full duty for a day. So your off day, you just hung around and were a desk officer or watched this or posted a board or did something like that. Or,
mm-hmm.
And most guys just slept or laid around or did nothing. There wasn't any place to go
mm-hmm.
at that point. And so I think we had the second shift, so I still had to do the scheduling and the rest of it. And then we got guys all checked in on how to do the schedule, so that when we flew, we didn't have to do it. So that all worked itself out pretty quick, and we jumped into things and generally just started flying. And we had some, I think, basically easier missions, they thought, in Laos and in the southern part of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
North Vietnam. And they were primarily, I think, when the very first ones were bridges, interdiction-type targets.
Mm-hmm.
And
in Laos, were you dropping on the trail complex?
Yeah, there was what's called a Route 5 was a basic mm-hmm. thing that wound around. And we found out that they shot at you a lot from a couple of places.
Mm-hmm.
And we almost always went to the North Vietnam over Laos.
Okay.
In other words, we just took off, went right over Laos, and
mm-hmm.
went that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all our tankers were, up on the border. And actually, they went into Laos when we were refueling. We refueled every mission.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sometimes twice. But we kind of got into that, and then we found out we had a mission because the 104s that were flying out of Da Nang were called home, and so we picked up what they call a Queen Bee mission, which was to protect this electronic C-130 that was flying around up off of the coast of Haiphong
mm-hmm.
and collecting intelligence data. And so we went up there, and we'd had three tanks on board, just and Sparrow missiles and Sidewinders, and went up there to guard these guys. And
mm-hmm.
the MiGs had come barreling off the coast, and you'd pick one up, and then they'd turn real quick. So they just faked it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we chased one every now and then. The guy'd get overzealous, and he'd come a little too close. And I got behind one, but I couldn't have caught him by the time we'd overflown the coast, so they made us break off.
Okay.
But
Was that frustrating? Did you want to follow it?
Oh, yeah. You wanted to go zap him, but you had to get pretty close from the tail mm-hmm. to shoot anything.
Mm-hmm.
And those missions last sometimes 7 hours, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd go out there, and we didn't have water. We didn't have... I broke a tooth on a pork chop sandwich. They'd left the bone in one day, and that was our mess hall, but they didn't know much better. But
mm-hmm.
but that's kind of how and we carried baby bottles that someone told us to buy, and everyone had two or three baby bottles. We'd fill them full of water and stick them in your G-suit pocket or wherever, because we had no other way to get water.
Mm-hmm.
And that long a mission, you needed something.
Mm-hmm.
But... we did that for a few days, and then it kind of got to the point where most of the pilots started sitting around griping and complaining. We had a little club annex thing, mm-hmm. and guys would go in there and sit around having a beer, and pretty soon it started people saying, "My God, so-and-so did this. This was really stupid."
Mm-hmm.
And
other pilots, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily it was... Our flight leaders and our commander, ops officer, and assistant ops officer, hardly any of them had really much experience dropping bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And the other problem was we didn't have tactical ranges then. So the only thing you did was go in and fly in a circle and drop bombs on a range.
Mm-hmm.
And those are very controlled because you don't want people getting in trouble running around different directions, and so and it's primarily a training or a checkout kind of thing. So people just fly around in a circle, all at the same altitude, all above the ground,
mm-hmm.
all at the same speed. And if you think about it, as a gunner sitting on the ground, even if it's all optical, you pretty well solve a lot of problems. You know he's going to be on this corner at X time, just
mm-hmm.
about a year,
mm-hmm.
so you don't have to aim the gun a lot. And then they're all going to come roaring down low level, coming from this heading. So if we all concentrate our AAA at this one spot, someone's bound to fly through it. And that is kind of what started happening. A few guys picked up holes, and they started complaining to our gunnery officer and some of the other younger guys, these guys are trying to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to vary these things and do something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of us and a lot of the different flights experimented around and said, okay, like our flight commander happened to be a reconnaissance pilot. He'd never had gunnery in his life until he got to MacDill, and that was very small. So he could see anything because
mm-hmm.
he was used to it. But he wasn't the greatest bomber in the world.
Right.
But at least he said, I understand what's happening. Let's try splitting up into two-ship formations when we get around the target area and kind of attack separately from two different guys, and
mm-hmm.
we can call where we are, and we shouldn't have any problem running into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, that might be better than getting hosed. So most of us started doing stuff like that, except our basic commander and ops officer. Our ops officer was just awful.
Mm-hmm.
And he had flown his whole life in Strategic Air Command, bombers, and then he got into fighters, but his fighters were nuke carrier, and he never did anything different, ever, mm-hmm. until he got there. So, and he'd do anything. He was fearless. He'd go anywhere you wanted, except he insisted you do follow me kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got to the point of where no one wanted to even fly with him.
Right.
And so this started picking up, and it wasn't long. It was probably 2-3 weeks. And a few guys, as I said, had taken holes, and then suddenly they started getting us into more complicated missions. And we started getting into the Hanoi area.
Okay.
And we started getting up there with 105s and trying to to bomb, and then we would secondarily hang around as long as we could to try and provide some sort of mid-cap for the 105s.
Mm-hmm.
And not too long after we were there, it wasn't probably more than 3 weeks, they found out where this SAM site was that shot down Dick Kern. So they decided we were going to take out that SAM site and teach them a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Up till that time, our rules of engagement, you couldn't attack a SAM site.
Why is that?
Because they hadn't shot at us yet.
Okay.
And the other was that we couldn't attack an airfield because they'd never attacked our airfields.
Now, what did you personally and what did your unit think about such?
Well, we all thought it was idiocy.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that we had these rules of engagement. And everything in those days, of course, was grease pencil board. So we had this huge grease pencil board, and it was the rules of engagement. It was just full. And you'd see these things, and they'd change about once a week. So you had to make sure what you could do or what you couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And every time they'd come out with another one, it seemed like it was stupider. And these came out of Headquarters Air Force or Headquarters whatever, and a Pentagon someplace.
Mm-hmm.
But it was things like, if you shoot at a, if there's a anti-aircraft battery posted in the city, in the town square, you couldn't attack it even if they shot at you, because you might hit somebody else.
Right.
And of course, those days, a good bomber, we could maybe get 50, 60 feet from the target.
Mm-hmm.
That's an average. So those things came up, and that was frustrating. But most of us learned to live with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty crummy when you'd fly over Fukien Airport and see MiGs sitting on the ground, and you couldn't attack them.
Right, I can imagine.
And yet they'd shoot, just everybody would open up and shoot at you. But we could go bomb the ammunition dump that was on the one end of the field, but we couldn't bomb the field.
Mm.
And that kind of stuff. So there were a lot of restrictions that really made people mad.
And this is early on in the
yeah, this was,
long scheme of conflict.
July, August of 65.
Mm-hmm.
And another one, too, is we'd go out over these things and we'd see these sampans and different stuff coming down the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be in groups of three and four, and you knew they were carrying stuff. You could actually, we'd go buzz them every once in a while if you had gas.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see munitions on them.
Mm.
And we'd say, let us hit those. No, they could be fishermen. And it's kind of like they're trying to do today, only they had really no control over it.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd see junks and stuff, and they're going down there, and then they'd shoot at you, but you couldn't shoot at them.
And they knew this, so they were...
Well, yeah, they obviously knew it, because they could
mm-hmm.
get away with it.
Right.
And so we kind of fought that off, and a combination of guys that really didn't have much experience and the rules we had to follow started irking everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So we got pretty surly pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you'd end up doing, and I was a scheduling officer, but you'd end up putting people that didn't care what they flew, and you'd try and give, like, our ops officer, we tried to give him kind of an easy target or one that probably wasn't going to get him shot at too bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd put guys in there that didn't mind flying with the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of try and control it a little bit, and then the tougher targets, we tried to put the people that were a little better qualified that tried to use different tactics.
Who actually picked the targets?
They came out of Headquarters Air Force.
Okay.
And that was another problem. They'd have what they call Joint Chiefs of Staff targets,
mm-hmm.
JCS targets, and the Air Force had a huge book, and it was called a bombing manual, one of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it told, for example, they'd say a double-span bridge, 182 feet long with three abutments, whatever, it'll take 82 fighters dropping X amount of bombs on it. And so they'd say, okay, divide 82 by 4, come up with how many flights you're going to put out, put a couple of spare flights for anybody that dropped out, all the tankers up, and they'd say hit JCS-1, which would be a bridge. And so you'd end up there within 5 minutes of each other, 80 airplanes in a row in a big stream coming from the same direction, and all try and bomb this bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, bridges weren't a fun target because, one, they're really hard to hit with a visual bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And, secondly, they're strong. If you really hit them, if you just hit the top or whatever, the bomb goes off, doesn't hurt the bridge. But you had to get the abutment where the bridge was held on, learn how bridges were made so you can get the weak point.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not, they wanted us to blow off the middle and things like that. But those JCS targets were generally really crummy. People hated them because they were all done just academically. They had nothing to do with any kind of sensible targeting, it seemed like.
When you got over the target, did you guys compensate for that, or did you follow
the script? Well, you just did what you had to do. We tried to split targets and do whatever, but when you're in a... We'd go in there, and normally we were the second guys in, or we'd go in first with maybe two flights, go in and drop everything we were carrying in one pass, pull off, and then we'd go up and orbit so we could look for MiGs in case MiGs came to attack the strike force.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor thuds, by the time they got there, the 105s, all the gunners were awake, and they were all, they figured out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor 105s would take the brunt of it.
Mm.
And so those poor guys would come in. And, of course, the 105 was a great airplane, but it's a nuke bomber.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't made to be a dive bomber or an air-to-air machine. So, again, we had a mixed-mash, another mixed-mash airplane trying to do the lion's share of the bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And, they did about as good a job as you could expect. And most of the guys there in those days were pretty experienced, especially the 105 guys, because they were flying out of Japan and Okinawa, and they'd been trained, and they'd been up there for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we had quite a bit of experience, although not in the F-4 so much, but most of us had 150 hours to 200 hours in the airplane,
mm-hmm.
which is not a whole lot. But that's kind of the way it went. It didn't make much difference what the target was. There was always something that seemed to kind of make guys mad. And we had successes in there, too, where we'd catch up with something. We'd find out it was a barracks area that was supposed to be full of guys that were going to go into South Vietnam, and someone got some intelligence, and we'd get put on it. And we carried the F-4 primarily. Our primary weapon at the first was 10 750-pound bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge payload in those days. And that's more than a B-17 carry.
Right.
But we just destroyed this one barracks, and apparently there was all kinds of guys inside, and we hit them really super early in the morning. And,
mm-hmm.
But someone let us do that, actually. Seems like the successes were where someone in the Air Force that knew what they should be doing directed it.
Right.
But when they came out of these JCS things and whatever, most of them were just awful.
Mm-hmm.
But
you guys had no choice. You had to follow what.
Yeah, you just do whatever they say do. And, of course, mm-hmm. we're young, and that's the way you do it anyway. And guys gripe, but they didn't gripe that much.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't had any losses. Until this one target, we lost a guy, and he bailed out over water.
Mm-hmm.
But he got out of it. And we just didn't have any, other than the original shoot down, we didn't have any of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Did you have any personal incidents that you recall from this TDY that were just going to stand
out?
Oh,
yeah, lots of different ones. As... matter of fact, is talking about the original shootdown is
mm-hmm.
is we were in there to bomb this to be back up and mid cap and whatever for the SAM site. They decided since they shut down Dick Kern, they were going to kill the SAM site. So they got this huge strike force. Again, they went into the manual and said it's going to take 60 something whatever 105s to bomb it. And they all came in these huge formations. Well, if they had any radar at all, you could see these guys in a big, huge stream.
Mm-hmm.
And us, too, flying above them and mid-cap. And they came in, and they'd actually moved the missiles and had fake missiles up there and set up AAA and all kinds of stuff from every direction around this so-called SAM site.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't anything there. And they just murdered the 105s. I think they shot down 3 or 4 airplanes.
Mm.
And that was just what an eye-opener to us to see this kind of leadership coming out. How stupid could you be?
Mm-hmm.
And we were one of the last flights remaining as all this came out. We were orbiting over on the other side of Fujian Airport, which was their primary base, watching to see if they scrambled MiGs. And we heard a rescue attempt coming in. And that's when we saw what happened in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
But this gray helicopter, CH-3C, I remember it was just the one before the Jolly Green, came fluttering along out of nowhere and was calling in stuff, and we suddenly immediately became, tried to give him rescap.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as keeping MiGs off of him, but we had nothing to strafe with or shoot at the ground. And he got in there, and by golly, he pulled out one of these pilots, 105 guy.
Hmm.
And he was getting shot at, and they were screaming, and you could hear all this stuff over these frequencies. And we watched him coming out, and he was taking lots of fire that we could see from tracers. And he made it to a little spot, and all of a sudden we thought he was going down, and there was this little bitty kind of place on top of a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat down on it. And that's when we learned about Lima sites.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy actually went in there, and they said there were, I guess, 3 on board. They're all CIA guys. And they went in there and hand-pumped fuel out of 60-gallon drums into that helicopter to make
wow.
it back.
Wow.
And apparently they had a hard time getting there. So,
mm-hmm.
And they had this poor pilot that was down there with guys all around him, and apparently they just yanked him out of the middle of them.
Mm.
And matter of fact, I even met the guy later at Karat when we had a meeting. And
mm-hmm.
and this guy, if there was anybody that you wouldn't think would be a hero, it was him.
Really?
You know, he was little bitty. Not little bitty, but he was probably 5'4" or 5".
Mm-hmm.
Maybe weighed 130.
Mm-hmm.
And blondish hair, big smile, and pretty young, and he was Dutch.
Hmm.
And he was flying contract for whoever it was. They changed the name, Suburban Sun or somebody,
mm-hmm.
who was all these CIA guys in there flying. They were all contract people. They were
mm-hmm.
just working for nobody. And it just kind of struck me at that point that you always kind of see these guys that are heroes, you know, that are John Wayne and these big guys, and they're all tough and whatever. And here's this little bitty guy that, boy, he really, you know, the guy that's kind of like pulling this woman out of Iraq. And, it's just one of those incredible things. But
mm-hmm. And you got to witness it.
Yeah, and I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a biggie. We had lots of different missions that were tough. As things progressed and the missions got dumber and dumber, the Navy was always, we always kid the Navy about being very conscious of their image.
Mm-hmm.
And they took pictures all the time, and you'd always see Marines, and you still do today, but you always see Navy or Marines doing something, and you never saw the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first got the F-4s back at MacDill, they equipped us with gun cameras cameras. There were camera pods that actually fit on the end of the wing where our drop tanks were. And they were set up for us to photograph the Mercury capsules when they were firing them out of Cape Canaveral.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd put up 6-7 F-4s and all make these runs. And as the Mercury finally got fired and came up, we were supposed to pull up and photograph the separation of the capsule.
Okay.
And I never got a pictures of the thing. I was always on the wrong end of the string. But we did get some pictures where you actually whip up and pull in a huge big climb, plug everything going like hell and supersonic, and you pull up and try and catch it and get photographs of this.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the guys did really well. I mean, we all got to do it off and on, or some of us did. And so suddenly they came, the Air Force came up with this idea, we need pictures. So they said, hey, guess what? The Air Force at Ubon are already wired. They've got these camera things, and we'll just ship them some cameras, and we'll send a couple of enlisted photographers from the Air Force photography, whatever, at Norton, and get these great pictures to show what everybody's doing over there.
Mm-hmm.
And our main job was to take pictures of 105s because they were the primary workhorse, and we wanted to do that. And they said, well, wait a minute. We're going to have this enlisted photographer in the back that doesn't know how to run the radars or anything.
Mm-hmm.
We can't carry missiles that we can fire. We can only carry radar missiles that requires the backseater to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going up there unarmed, basically, even though we had missiles on board. And we were supposed to take pictures of these 105s as they bombed the target.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got one of these missions, and we did. They went to the tanker, and we got pictures of them as they were joining up, getting on the tanker. And the back guy was shooting shots of all the different guys, and they were waving, and you know, great, and taking pictures up close of the bombs hanging in the bottom of the airplane, that kind of stuff. And we went in, and finally, they said, "Okay, we're going into this target," and we didn't really. We're briefed on where the target was. Well, it was really a nasty target.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, right close to Haiphong, or Hanoi. And so these guys all, they bunch up and they do whatever and got all ready, and we decided we'd pick these last two guys, the 3 and 4 man, and I'd follow them down and take the pictures as they were in their dive bomb pass. And, and take pictures of the target, and then I could also get the bombs from the guy in front of them as they hit, probably. So we did this, and all of a sudden, you concentrate on what you're doing, you don't pay any attention, and the guy in the back's just screeching and screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I actually, once I got the pictures and started to pull off, I realized we were just covered with flak, just everywhere.
Mm.
And this guy was just screaming his head off. And then I have to whip around and get the next flight coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this time all the gunners were awake and they were really mad.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to go through it again, and this time the guy's screeching before we even start.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling him to shut up and go cold mic, and he didn't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally we got through with it, and amazingly made it through this whole thing and didn't seem to have any problem. And whipped out of there, and all the 105s, that's their... They're designed to go low level at high speed.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys went low level, and they just walked away from us. And here I am with no way to fire a weapon, 400 miles from home, at about 1,000 feet, about 0.9 Mach, trying to get out of town and by myself. So I got back, and I couldn't believe it. Finally got this guy to shut up and get sensible, and we pulled up to altitude. I had to hit a tanker because we were out of gas. Went back to Ubon. I went in. We looked at the airplane. We were going to unload the thing, and one of the pieces of flak had photographed the explosion. I mean, the camera had photographed a piece of an explosion that had hit out in front of us, and a piece of it actually hit the lens of the camera.
Mm.
And but I didn't get hit at all, and I came back and just probably blew my top and screeched a lot at our commanders and took off for the club and sat down and had a drink.
Mm-hmm.
But after two other guys flew those same missions, and they came back about the same way I did, and they said, you're going to have to court-martial me to fly another one of those. That's the dumbest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So they did finally say, well, maybe that's not smart. And stopped them. But that was one of the great things that happened there, too.
Right. How your commanders, how much did they really listen to you and what your complaints were, or what you
They didn't.
Why did they not listen to you?
I don't know.
That seems to go against logic, that they are...
Well, it is. Our commander was had just the highest credentials you can get in the Air Force, almost. He was a Thunderbird leader,
mm-hmm.
flying 100s. I mean, he fit the part every time. He, you know, the old straight teeth, crooked smile, good looking,
mm-hmm.
Swaggered. I mean, he just was perfect. And we thought, oh boy, we got this wonderful commander. And but he didn't know a whole lot about bombing. He's a great pilot, and he also didn't like some of the tough missions, and we finally realized he was scheduling himself for the easy stuff. And then the ops officer was kind of the exact opposite. He wanted the tough stuff and kind of prove himself all the time, and he was just a horrible tactician.
Mm-hmm.
So he put his guys in jeopardy every time. Matter of fact, I think he lost all but two airplanes we lost.
Wow.
So, and we lost, six airplanes, I guess. So,
how did you deal with the knowledge that any of these missions could be your last mission, that you could die?
Oh.
This basic fear.
It's a real lie if anybody said they weren't scared. We all were, but it was the whole idea that you had to be tough was mm-hmm. stronger than the fear.
Okay.
And so everybody basically hit it. They all would complain a little bit. But matter of fact, my wife, who is a psychologist, basically said fighter pilots are a subculture, that they're all nuts. And
right.
We kind of did the same thing. And I think it's just generally as fighter pilots anyway. And I haven't been anything else, or that's the way I learned.
Mm-hmm.
If someone crashes or if someone makes a mistake and does something wrong, you look at what the guy did, and you try and go through it in very logical, piece-by-piece manner,
mm-hmm.
and say, where is it he screwed up?
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, if I ever get there, I'm not going to do it. I might have lived.
Okay.
So when we started losing people, which we all did... in September, basically, is when we lost literally everybody but Dick Kern,
mm-hmm.
September of 65. It was like every couple of days we'd lose somebody. And we lost them dead. We lost them to, we know they were prisoners, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But every time that happened, you'd kind of sit back and you'd try and find as much out about the mission and how it went and where you were. And that's why a lot of us had put it in the flight leader and say he put him in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of us kind of zeroed in on the ops officer.
Right.
And even our commander finally shipped him off the base for a while by himself. He didn't even have anybody with him. But that was kind of generally it. And... we were also, most of us somebody would have to become a summary courts officer, which had to go through and pack the guy's clothes and do all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was tough. I did for one of my best friends. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would go to the bar and they'd toast the guy probably toast him way too many times.
Mm-hmm.
And that might happen for 2 days, but it was kind of, then it had to be over.
Right.
And, I don't know, it was just kind of a funny thing, but that's just the way most people handle it. People cried out in the night sometimes.
In their sleep?
Yeah.
What would they cry out?
Oh, guy's name. Break, do this.
Mm.
Different things, and nobody ever really nobody ever really said much about it or ever really admitted it.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I've woken up a number of times after stuff, and you wonder if you were noisy. You're kind of worried that somebody would find out if you were scared.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think it's a combination of a lot of different things, the way that happened. And we lost all these people all at the same time, it seemed like, and it was just like two or three of them were really, really close. Which, even in a squadron, although you know everybody and you're close, you're not as close.
Mm-hmm.
So those things kind of got to us. And in the meanwhile, someone would go home, and then you'd hear something from the family. And all that stuff's going on at home that nobody can tell anybody what's going on. And we were, letters had crossed mid-Pacific somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd hear this stuff. But that's going on at home. And then even some of the guys would write, like my backseater's wife would say, Fran's having a tough time of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't do anything.
How often did you write her?
Oh, almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
And this other, probably one of my best friends, even till today, he was kind of a photo bug.
Mm-hmm.
And we finally got this little BX, and I bought a camera. And we'd walk on our days off, or whenever we had time off, we'd just go walking in the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And take pictures. And consequently, I got lots of pictures of little Thai kids and
mm-hmm.
Buddhas, temples, and junk, and water buffaloes, and whatever. But it was good to get out and just do something.
Right.
And some people read. I'm an avid reader, but I just couldn't concentrate on reading.
Hmm. Why not?
I don't know. I just couldn't make myself sit down and do it.
Mm-hmm.
I needed to be outside in the open, or kind of just was good for me.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to get off base and go downtown, and some of these little Thai restaurants weren't bad, and actually it was better than the mess hall.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go down and get haircuts about every third day.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of something to do. So it was always good to get away. They had a couple of clubs down there. One, I think the big favorite was called the King Star.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have these Japanese rock bands come in. They were just awful. Most of us didn't really go. Our enlisted really liked them, and generally that was the only thing they got to even get off the base.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd go down there, but they drank this old miserable, what they called the white cock. It was a... had a rooster on it,
mm-hmm.
but it tasted like that awful, that kind of sweet bourbon stuff with Southern Comfort.
Mm-hmm.
God, it was awful. And so they had good beer, though. They had this Singhai beer, so most of us drank beer. But we had some Australians that came out from Penang
mm-hmm.
in the Malay, and they were really good guys. And we'd fly against them sometimes when we had a chance coming back from a mission.
Mm-hmm.
And they helped us a lot as far as if we ever were going to really meet an enemy, because they flew these souped-up F-86s that really behaved like MiGs.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave us a lot of practice, which we just did on our own. It was illegal, but we all did it.
Right.
And that kind of stuff. We had really crummy munitions at first. The propellers would spin off the end of the bomb, and then they'd all be armed while you were carrying them.
Hmm.
And if you hit a bird, or sometimes even if you dropped them, when the explosive charge drops them off the rack,
mm-hmm.
they could blow up. So we kind of got through that. We had some really crummy... I shot a bullpup missile at the Than Hoa Bridge, which was probably one of the scary ones.
Mm-hmm.
And all it did was just draw... It leaves a big white plume right where it came from.
Right.
And it's just like an arrow. So uh-huh. I got about three SAMs shot at me instantly. So I just left.
What did you do to evade those?
I just turned the missile straight up and we had a little controller in the cockpit. You actually steered it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just pointed it toward the what I thought might make it into the bridge and just left.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It broke, and the SAMs just went on.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some real missile problems. They had this old Korean, a lot of them were Korean stuff, and they weren't meant to fly on fast airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a terminal velocity fuse, VT fuse, which has a little radar in it, and it's supposed to blow up 500 feet above the ground, say.
Mm-hmm.
And that was supposed to be a great weapon for anti-aircraft or for SAMs or whatever.
Right.
And they thought, boy, we can put that fuse on the nose of our regular bombs, and we can bomb with those, and that'll be a great weapon. They just didn't realize that it wasn't made to go that fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were still armed, like most of them, with little propellers. And a 105 guy was flying with one, and the little propeller armed it, and he pulled up to get fuel in the tanker.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got 500 feet from the tanker, it blew up.
Mm.
And we had been scheduled, Jim and I, my backseater, had been scheduled to fly one of those missions the day before and got grounded for weather. So it's,
wow.
You think of those things after the fact, but
right.
But that's the kind of thinking. We got a lot of this thinking out of the Pentagon because we weren't allowed to do it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the generals that were over there, a lot of them were good fighter people, tried to do it, they just, it was always taken out of their hands, it seemed.
Yeah.
And the rules changed weekly.
What rules?
1 week we could shoot at these guys, and the next mm-hmm. week we couldn't shoot at them, and then we could shoot MiGs, and then we couldn't shoot MiGs, and then we could attack SAM sites, and then we couldn't attack them.
Why was that, do you think?
I have no idea. I think it was all the political idea of when they had talks, and they said, if we don't do this, the Vietnamese will become nice.
Okay.
And let us do it. I don't know. I mean, I'm just, that's kind of a facetious statement, but it...
I understand what you're saying.
But it...
It was based on political talks and
a lot of politics had to be involved in it, I'm sure. And, of course, after the war, I read a lot of good books about guys that actually did research and looked at some of these things. And, in mm-hmm. fact, a lot of that was true. But, the whole idea that we were in Laos and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's funny, too, is this, my flight commander and I flew a mission in Laos one day.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a couple airplanes we always had loaded with kind of a mixed load. We'd have a gun and rockets, and we'd have bombs and napalm. And if we got a call from these guys in Laos that they were in trouble, we became their close air support. And they flew around in these little T-28s
mm-hmm.
and or O-1s and would give directions to us where the guys are and whatever. And it was usually these little Lima sites that were on top of a hill somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Ray and I got scrambled one evening. It was just about the end of flying, we thought. And we got scrambled, and they sent us up to this guy. We talked to him, and he's obviously an American because he's... Yes, you can't miss an American talking versus a Thai or a,
mm-hmm.
or a Australian or somebody. And apparently the Vang Pao, who is now everybody knows, was a Lao commander
mm-hmm.
of our buddies that supported the CIA effort.
Mm-hmm.
He was in trouble up at this one place. And we came in, it was evening, and the bad guys, and they... when you say the army's attacking him, but the army is about probably 150 people.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, the bad guys were in one place, and we came in and worked them over pretty good and got a couple of really good lucky hits and
mm-hmm.
and stopped them. And it was dark, literally. I mean, we were really bombing in the dark, and those mountains is really tough. Thai,
mm-hmm.
Laos is really a strange country. You almost have to see it to believe it, but mm-hmm. it always, these karsts that stuck up out of the ground
mm-hmm.
were just sheer granite-looking, gray granite-looking cliffs that just would stand up like a knife blade.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd just be out there. And it, maybe some of them would be on the edge of a little thing that was maybe a couple hundred yards wide, and then mm-hmm. it would drop off on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And all these little valleys and stuff. And it was huge jungles. And it just all these little things. And it was really kind of pretty, because every morning you'd have clouds over the little valleys. And it was, I don't know, it just kind of looked like, I think I said before one time, it looked like one of those things that you went to one of those bad movies. They said mm-hmm. this land was forgotten and the dinosaurs mm-hmm. were walking around.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminded me of that kind of thing. But anyway, we got these guys and came back, and went over to the bar, and boy, we're happy with each other, and we did a good job. And boy, the next morning, or late that night sometime, I got told early the next morning, we had gotten a commendation from Ambassador Sullivan, who was
really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Said, "Nice going. You really did it great. No, mm-hmm. how wonderful and everything." And we thought, "Oh boy, we're going to get a medal out of this one."
Mm-hmm.
And we were just patting ourselves on the back, and I think it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. We got a thing, and our commander and everybody ran us down and said, "You didn't say anything, did you? Whatever, you give me that thing back. Any copies you made, did you make copies?" We had to swear to heaven that we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And they took it back, and they said, "Wait a minute, we can't say that, because
mm-hmm.
we aren't there."
That's right.
And so they took it away. So we
that
was kind of like, "Oh, come on."
Can you keep
but
it
I
secret?
Never forget that. It was really funny.
What did you think of the United States being in this supposed neutral country?
Oh, it didn't even dawn on me at the time that anything was really wrong or different or whatever
mm-hmm.
with that. I just knew that it was politics, and the Chinese were building roads up there.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that, and we could see them, but they were communist Chinese, not North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
There were things going on all over that poor old country.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor people down there are just like American Indians, kind of. They were just naturists. All they did was grow poppies and a little millet, and that was
mm-hmm.
life. And we came in there and screwed it all up.
Mm-hmm.
But the Plain of Jars is another one. I did a low-level run over that time, just one because
mm-hmm.
everybody wanted to do it and see it. But these burial jars they have up there are huge.
Mm-hmm.
They must be 10, 15 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
Huge things.
And no one knows how they got there.
And no, that's right. I mean, it's just some civilization had them, and they made these things, and they know they're full of bones.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, Sol Pot or somebody from Cambodia or who.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. This was kind of a thing that went on, and I was young, and most of us were, and we weren't very political.
Right.
And these things just happened, and finally you got to realizing by the time we were there a while that this stuff was habitual.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of us decided the way you're going to stay alive is to just kind of keep it to yourself, don't say too much, and just do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we developed our own tactics. We talked about it. We did certain stuff. We always ran in and anytime they'd say, "I want you to bomb on this heading," we'd go in and say, "That's a dumb heading because it puts us right here. Let's bomb out of the sun."
Mm-hmm.
And we'd just change it around, never tell anybody.
Okay.
So, and the other thing I think that irked everybody the most was that we really were winning that war to a degree.
In Laos or in Vietnam?
In both.
Mm-hmm.
We actually were shutting down stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell. When we first got there, there was a lot more firepower coming back at you. The MiGs were, started flying. Then they suddenly all went down. We had no MiGs flying at all.
Mm-hmm.
The railroads quit running. Trains, we saw them at first. We didn't see them later. Supplies, there weren't as many boats in Haiphong Harbor. I mean, all these things were happening. And we were making some headway in spite of the leadership. And, of course, after we left, which was shortly after that Christmas, that's when the administration says we're going to stand down for Christmas
mm-hmm.
and Tet. So they resupplied everything. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, we're three times stronger than they were when we were there.
Right.
But I think, frankly, that's just me, but I think we had a good shot at it of really controlling that situation if we'd
mm-hmm.
let some people that knew what they were doing really run it.
meaning in Washington and...
Let the military run it. I think most of the guys that are fighter guys knew what it took to be safer and how to put a lot of this stuff out of business.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't going to shut down things, but...
You could certainly make an impact.
Yeah, but some of the dumb stuff that we did to run all these little Sona boys and junk and throw them into the trees and supposedly know where all these trucks are and then try and go out and surprise them, well, they usually surprised us. And I think they knew more about than we did.
How effective was your interdiction on the Ho Chi Minh Trail complex?
We made a good start in a couple of places, and as I said, early on, and we owned Route 5, which was the northern Parrot Peak, which went into the Magia Pass and some of that. But we really did run a lot of that. We seeded that thing with bombs, and then they got smart how to handle those, but we'd do different things. We put in time delay stuff. We did lots of different stuff that worked. And we even started flying at night, which the F-4 could do. And but unfortunately, our airplanes were painted white on the bottom, and that wasn't a great great deal at night under a flare.
Right.
But
did you prefer daytime or nighttime flying?
Oh, daytime. We didn't do very much night in those days. And they started doing more and more of it later. But we flew probably, maybe 10 different missions of night flying in our whole squadron. So, it wasn't a lot. It was all, I mean, that's the other thing that came out of Washington is somebody said, and I don't know if it's true, but that McNamara or whoever up in the JCS area wanted to know what was going on at... when they came in the first thing for their morning briefing. So they scheduled that thing anyway. They started scheduling their briefings around first light target hits. So they would stay later or whatever, and 12 hours difference, however that worked. And they'd do them at the time we either do that or we'd have these late afternoon ones. So it kind of got to the point of any JCS target that ever came out, you knew when it was going to be, what time it was. And it was that was kind of really feel like, gosh, don't give us an edge here. Put us into these gigantic formations with all this warning, do whatever, and then put us in when they know we're coming. But it it kind of got that way. So finally we got through it, and we finally got some R&R, got to go to Saigon, or to Bangkok for a couple of days. And it was great. We all booted ourselves out. There's so many Buddhas running around down there. You had to go see them all, and and snake farms and elephants and the Thai, formal Thai dancing, and and lots of good food. But that's all we did was eat and buy presents for Christmas, because we were thinking about that. So everybody got their little three-day stint, and that included flying down there and back.
How long was the CDY?
We ended up mid-July, I guess, till I know we left on November 20th out of Yuban. The reason I know that's we became godparents to my Betty's daughter, who was born on November 20th. Matter of fact, I ended up leaving my second tour on the same date, which was really
interesting,
ironic.
What did you think of the Thai civilians?
We didn't see them a lot. We saw mainly little Thai guards. We had some guys down in these restaurants that we met, although a lot of those were Indians. We, Russ and I, actually, who my buddy who took pictures, we talked a lot to a group of monks. And I'd taken great religions and some stuff in school and knew a little bit about Buddhism. And we went out and talked to these guys who were college educated. And... that we talked to, a couple of them, and we'd go out there and have tea with them and sit around, and we took little gifts and stuff, and it was somebody who was really fun to see. But the average guy running around the street, we had a favorite barber But he didn't. They didn't say anything. Most of them couldn't speak any English at all.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, Bangkok was a huge city. A lot of them spoke English down there. But that was just a a whole different ball game than up there in the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
But we finally made it through and lost all these guys in I think it was 2.5-3 weeks, and everybody but the guy that we lost the day we got there. And so the end of the tour was really kind of nasty. Everybody was really ready to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And we got out of there on November 20th and at 1:30. I think there were two airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
We got to be the first group that left. We got down to Clark, the Philippines, and we were supposed to stay at the Ambassador Officers' Quarters, and they didn't have rooms. They'd done something else and taken the quarters for some meeting or something, and so they put us in this old, dilapidated, condemned housing that had been enlisted housing,
mm-hmm.
and it was just one giant bug.
Mm.
I mean, Thailand was bug capital of the world, but boy, Clark was a close second, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I was sure happy to get rid of snakes and centipedes and mm-hmm. bugs and frogs and rats, which we had routinely.
Did you have encounters with snakes in Thailand?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Inside the barracks?
Well, we didn't really have much of an inside. It was usually mm-hmm. outside under these little slats.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody would see a crate, crates mostly. We did see a couple of small cobras.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd get down on the, we had some revetments where guys had put these, what they call lightalls. They did all our maintenance at night, most
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be down there with all these lights, and these light things would make a lot of warmth. And these snakes would crawl up there out of the rice paddy.
Wow.
And our enlisted saw them most of the time. But if we happened to be down there for some reason, you'd see one. But
mm-hmm.
Rice bugs, those were huge.
Mm-hmm.
Big gray beetles. They were probably 2 inches long. Thais ate them like toothpaste. They'd just pop the head off.
Did you ever try that?
No. No. We didn't have Survivor in those days.
Right.
I've eaten a bug or two, but I think that was later.
Right.
But
so Clark was pretty bad then.
Oh, Clark was a mess, and we all took off, and he said the hell with them, and we thought, boy, well, all we need is a shower, and we're going to get clean clothes. Well, we didn't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
All we had is what we carried in flight suits,
mm.
and which were pretty grubby, you can imagine by then, because mm-hmm. our washateria was a couple of Thai women that carried him down and beat on him with a rock,
mm-hmm.
and everything was brown. I mean, we took stuff home just to show our wives.
Uh-huh.
It was so bad.
Uh-huh.
And all your socks were tube socks. They just stretched them that way to clean them.
Mm-hmm.
So they were sometimes to your knees. It was really kind of odd. Anyway, we ended up at Clark, went to the club, and got thrown out of the club because we were drunk and disorderly mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, kind of had a next day of sobering up till we got to the following evening, and we all piled on a DC-8, stretched DC-8,
mm-hmm.
and flew back to Travis, and then nonstop turned us around, refueled the airplane, and flew us to MacDill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fast, long trip, but it was great, great homecoming.
I can imagine. Why don't we take a break, sir?
Sure.